Hey, podcast listeners. This episode of Geek Speak, touchy-feely phone hacks, DOE with science. It is Saturday, September 19th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxel. With me in the studio is Brian Young, a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Were you about to say thinkerer?
I was going to say thinkerer.
I like that.
Yeah, unlike good. Me, you think. And also we have political junkie and software engineer, Mr. Miles Elam.
Hello.
We're going to do a lot of little news stories today on Geek Speak. So let's talk first about the new movements in prosthetics. I recently saw RoboCop, the remake. Do you, either of you guys seen that?
I saw clips of it and just...
And you avoided it like the plague, right?
Because
the 80s movie was enough. Do you remember, though, the future that they made in the 80s movie? It was it 80s that the first RoboCop came out? And like, I'll buy that for a dollar. And just like the insanity of market television, but also the commercialism of police forces. Mm-hmm.
Was that RoboCop or was that, what was the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger? Total Recall.
Like that? Same era, but it was a little different. But
something
I
thought was funny about RoboCop, just as an aside, they were optimistic about Detroit, it turns out.
It turns out they were optimistic about Detroit. Well, the remake was on Netflix, and so I decided to watch it the other night. I was bacheloring it by myself, decided to watch it. And actually, it was better than I thought it was going to be, which, you know, wasn't hard because I thought it was going to be horrible. But in it, of course, they're talking about, in it, they have prosthetics that are very similar to the prosthetics we have now, really, you know, full textural movement and everything. But also, they had, you know, well, he becomes a complete robot and he fully functions and all that with a hard metal skin. So you've got a story about this, I think.
Well, I guess we are one step closer to that, hopefully, in a better way in terms of defense contractors. But speaking of defense contractors, DARPA is responsible for this.
DARPA, what we love to hate?
Yeah. Well, no, it's just, I mean, DARPA, huge amount of money coming from the federal government, and some things come out, but for the most part, people know it through the internet, founded by DARPA.
That's right.
Originally called ARPANET.
The famous DARPA output.
Yeah.
DARPA's also sponsored self-driving cars, and a whole bunch of projects they do, kind of wild and crazy things that actually turn into things we
use. But for the most part, it's, hey, we gave you the internet. Just give us more money. So, at any rate, what they have created is a prosthetic hand that can sense touch. So a 28-year-old man who had been paralyzed for more than a decade is able to control this – actually, it's a two-finger claw with his mind, which has been done before, just like using impulses to change it. But he can also get the sensation of even light taps on there.
Wait, you mean he has feedback from his hand?
Yes.
Whoa. And so he feels stuff with his prosthetic?
Yes.
So
signals traveling back to his brain.
That is
allowing
awesome.
Him to more
figure
precisely
out,
control something.
And that would be important, of course, because that's half of what we do is touch or, you know, feel what we touch.
Yes.
So he can get feedback, like, to know if he's picked up the glass and holding it enough and things of that nature.
Yeah. There's
that's
also
cool.
that to know between a light touch and a heavy touch. Because we take for granted, you pick up the glass and you go, oh, I don't want to grip this any harder.
Sure.
Well, yeah. That's what you always see in all the...
Or for that matter, to let loose, go like, I don't want to grip this quite as much. It slips through.
Yeah, but when you see all the robot videos of them trying to do something delicate like that, they're crushing the glass or whatever because that feedback loop is so important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you have superhuman strength.
Did they talk about how they're connecting to the nerves? Is this in the hand or in where the hand is connecting to the
running
arm?
Running wires from part of his brain.
Running wires from part of his brain.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be the way to connect up,
the brain
up,
is
I guess.
Electrical.
Okay. Cool. Thank you for the story.
He was able to act.
And this was sponsored by DARPA, but
yes.
I'm assuming that he's actually – does he get to keep this prosthetic and keep using it? Is it a test only? seems like if you started using something like that, you'd want that to be something you owned.
No, I don't have clearance to be able to
okay.
access
fair enough, fair enough. okay, Brian, why don't we go ahead and talk about some phone news.
Okay, so this is a particular interest to me, and I think a lot of people that live up here in the Santa Cruz Mountains would find this particularly interesting. So there's a couple technologies that have been around a while, and they're rolling out to more and more people. First of all, the new iPhones are joining in with the rest of about 25 other smartphones that are going to be using something on the T-Mobile network, which they're calling Extended Range LTE. Basically, T-Mobile bought the 700 megahertz spectrum.
Oh, right. I remember when they did that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and this is really important. I think this is the old TV spectrum that was the analog TV spectrum that was taken back and then resold off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was first allocated to the somewhere in the UHF bands.
Yeah. And what's important about it is this particular frequency can penetrate trees and walls much better than most of the frequencies can that are available to the cell phone providers. So T-Mobile is rolling this out, and you have to have a phone that can use it. And on the Android side, there's been a number of phones that have had this out for about a year now. And it's pretty exciting to me that us iPhone users can catch up to it now if we want to buy into the new phones or whatever.
I can hear everybody with an Android device going, wah-ha-ha-ha. Yeah.
But really, this is more important because now T-Mobile is really making a play to be more of a top-tier provider. If this really works out and they're able to, by the end of the year, cover as many people as they say they are, they're approaching the same scale that AT&T and Verizon has. And with their pricing plans and other things, it's definitely becoming more inviting.
You know, T-Mobile's been very inviting for a long time. And unfortunately, I think you and I both have the same problem. We just don't have coverage from them at our homes.
No,
and therefore, they become – you can't do it.
Yeah. In fact, from my town to my home, which is about 4 miles, literally stops about 100 feet out of town.
So if they do improve the network, you could take advantage of the really great deals. Because T-Mobile does have some really wonderful packages, I mean, comparatively.
So not only does this range penetrate walls better, but it also is going to go further. So yeah. I'm going to be testing this out as soon as I get the chance to.
Does that mean you're getting a new iPhone?
I'm going to take them up on their offer. They'll send you a free one, and you can try it out and turn it back if you don't want it.
Awesome. All right. Miles, you got some phone news?
Yes, I do. Sony has been offering their Xperia Z3 phone, which on their promotional materials has someone, you know, looking like they're taking video underwater. You know, it's supposed to be a waterproof phone.
Wait. You can seriously touch the screen underwater and it'll react to it? Is that what's in the advertisement?
Well, the picture, it's a static photo that's on their marketing pages, and it's obviously underwater, and it's showing someone swimming under the water.
And they say Xperia.
Yeah. Except that Sony's gone, oh, wait, we don't actually mean that you can
go underwater.
Use that phone underwater. Well, what do they mean, right? Like, you can just put it. Well, apparently, aside from this photo that shows someone actually using the camera or the phone underneath the water, it says actually you can gently put it about 1.5 meters underwater and then gently bring it back out again.
Okay, 1.5 meters is pretty deep, but you mean no shaking, slowly, delicately.
Exactly.
And don't depress those buttons so that the water might find its way in.
Yes.
And do it quickly. Well, so theoretically you could take that picture. Right, because you could put the timer on, fire the picture, then slowly lower it underwater, and then click.
No, wait,
Or Bluetooth controlled.
Don't these capacitive screens, when water touches them, they think that a finger might be touching them as well?
Very big finger.
Now, so some people have thought, like, wait a second, I bought this phone, and I thought that's what I was going to get, and now they're changing it. Well, turns out Sony had a get-out-of-jail-free clause, which is saying, all claims are verified at the time of testing. However, as the mobile landscape changes quickly and new phone models are released on a continuous basis, we cannot guarantee that all claims are still valid as you read this.
That's in there. That's like the user agreement when you buy it. We think you're giving this, but maybe you're not.
When we started production, it was intended to have this, but as production went on, we found out that actually it didn't work at all, but
Miles, that's like buying a car that doesn't go anywhere. You're like, well, that wasn't the spec, but then later it wasn't. Or it doesn't work in the rain.
Exactly. Yeah. When we first had our new sedan, it didn't leak through the roof. But it does now, but, you know...
You know, technology is the only thing that works this way. Nobody would put up with this in any other facet of our lives. But why do we do it so much?
I don't know if we... I mean, I guess people feel a little stuck.
I don't know that people put up with it, though. There have been more than a few class action.
There's
going to
be a lawsuit on that
companies.
One. I mean, come on. People buy the phone thinking they're going to be able to go underwater with it. That's a really cool feature.
I mean, this does seem like it would still be splash resistant and probably would survive if you just dropped
it
underwater.
It would do better than an iPhone underwater. I mean, come on.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's 1.5 meters, and they tested it for 30 minutes.
One time.
What company tested? Like outside resource people?
Tried it? It was Sony.
Sony, okay. Yeah. All right, cool, thanks. All right, let's do one more phony kind of story.
Phony kind? It's a phony story.
Oh, good, yeah.
So this is another technology that's coming to the iPhone a little bit on the late side. But once again, it's the carrier here.
Are you excited about the new iPhones, Brian?
No, this is available on my iPhone. I'm not going to buy the new one.
Oh, okay.
No, this is because iOS 9 is coming out.
Which I am excited about, actually.
iOS 9, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, it's, depending on when you hear this, it may be out by the time you are listening to this live on the radio. However, iOS 9, when it comes out, is adding Wi-Fi calling to the AT&T network.
Oh, cool.
So what this means is if you're out of range for AT&T, which happens to be my provider and happens to be pretty bad at my house, and happens to be why I'd really like T-Mobile to get their act together. But if you want to try to use your phone, it can connect over your Wi-Fi to the AT&T network and make a call and take calls just like
we covered a story very similar to this recently. Was that Sprint that said yes to that? I believe it was. Yeah. I think that this is the second. I think that we're going to see.
Well, the second tier carriers definitely jumped on this beforehand. T-Mobile had this right away, and I think Sprint got it.
So to be really clear,
that.
Normally your cell phone operates with two different antennas, right? Actually, another one too, but we'll just start with the two. The cell phone, which is actually your phone service, if you will, it has a data channel, and also Wi-Fi, so you can connect to your home router and do Wi-Fi. And normally when you're making a phone call, it only uses cell service, except for T-Mobile for a long time. While you're on cell service, if you have good Wi-Fi, it'll actually transfer the call to Wi-Fi, which doesn't use your minutes, theoretically, except that they still charge you. So AT&T is doing that too now, which really is perfect for us, right?
Well, which is different from something like Skype or Hangouts, which you could call landline. You could call other phone numbers. It's just that caller ID that came through wouldn't be your phone number.
Okay. I can see a million eyes glaze over, and they just got really confused there. But the point is, I can't receive a cell phone call at my cell phone number at my house if I'm inside the house.
You don't get enough coverage.
Right. I end up maybe getting a message that somebody left a message, and then I have to go outside on my deck and make the call, and then sometimes the signal just isn't strong enough. But the idea here is that just like Google Voice or just like Apple's FaceTime audio or all the other audio, Skype is another one. All those technologies out there use whatever data connection you have. This takes the cell phone conversation and puts it across the data network as well.
Seamlessly.
Hopefully. Well, hopefully. I don't know. Have you guys tried this yet?
No, I haven't actually.
So long, long time ago, I signed up for something called Grand Central, which then was bought by Google and called Google Voice. And I did this exclusively because I wanted to not have to rely on my cell connection when I would go to my house and just not be able to make or take calls. But by doing this over the internet, which is what these services offered, I would be free to make and take those calls over my Wi-Fi. But it's never worked that well. I bought specific devices, and I've tuned my router, and I've done everything I can to get the quality of service on my connection good enough to make a consistent phone call.
Yeah.
And to this day, my wife is telling me we have to go back to a landline, which we use so little.
Now, is this an OS update, or is it just AT&T doing it?
This is for AT&T specifically, but it's only available when you have iOS 9 installed on your iPhone.
Now, which is coming out on Friday, the day before this airs.
Now, again, Android devices, there are some already that have this on the AT&T network.
Of course, yeah.
Right. And technically, you can use Google Hangouts and dial up without having to over Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah. But then again, you have to connect your number to that service and maybe pay for it to get it seamless for somebody else so they, they know where to reach
right,
you.
Right, this is, yeah, the same
That whole area is so frustrating. Hey, we'll talk a little bit more about it in just a minute. Please stay with us, won't you? You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the air room is Brian Young and Miles Elam. We're chatting a bit about AT&T and iOS 9 and stuff. And I thought actually we'd continue a little bit about iOS 9 because we haven't actually covered it very well on the show. I'd like to chat a little bit about it. Are either of you excited about anything that's happening
yes,
in iOS?
Yes, I'm excited about iOS 9 because it will be smaller. It will take up less space. The applications are taking up less space because they're not going to be, here's the version of the app for all devices that are available. It's just going to be, this is the code that runs on your device.
So it's been for a long time that when you build an app for the App Store and you put it up so you can download on an iPhone or an iPad, when you do that, if it's a universal app, you want all the images and everything that's a part of that to work really well on an iPhone 4, an iPhone 5, an iPhone 6, a 6 Plus, and an iPad, two different versions of iPad. And so all of those images that you might use in that application would be a new copy of that image. It's slightly different. So it looks really good on all those devices. And what you're saying with iOS 9, that changes?
It's not just the images, though. This is also the code that gets run as well. The optimizations that are made, instead of having, because different devices have different features available, different generations of phones will have different processors. The iPad Pro will have different GPUs capabilities. You'll have those different code paths all baked in.
Yeah.
And if you have an iPad Air too, it will take one code path. If you have an iPhone 5, then it'll take another one.
Saying code path is a little confusing. It literally produces a different binary for each of those different processors that run in them. So when you download an app to your iPhone or your iPad, it literally is two different binaries, even though the developer wrote the same code for both of them with minor changes. Mm-hmm. So with this technology they're rolling out, it's only going to download one of those to your phone, not both of them like it's done in the past.
Or multiples of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this all depends on the developers adopting Apple's new technology.
That's true.
Right.
Additionally, though, another benefit of that is that when the app is upgraded or the operating system is upgraded, instead of getting another copy of that entire application, even though it would be smaller because it'll be one for one device, you actually get a diff of some sort, only a partly of the changes that would be required to upgrade it. Mostly it's for the operating system. I don't know if apps can actually take
it. Apps, well, the way it works with apps is that you download like this core part of the app.
Yeah.
And then if the developer chooses to take advantage of this, there's all these other parts of the app it can download as needed.
Oh, I see.
And it's mainly about resources.
So basically you'd specify like a level of a game as a resource. And if you upgrade the app and you haven't changed the level, they still have that level.
That's primarily what it's for.
This is the type of optimizations that were brought out with Android 5, where they made it so that it was optimized when you first install it onto the phone rather than on every single iteration it would do a just-in-time compilation.
Sure.
So
that's a different situation because, of course, Java is the deploy. So
right.
You can potentially...
Well, something like Java, but not really. But I'm excited about it because I'm not in a hurry to get a new phone just yet. The 6X is out, but I'm not going to try to wait forever for the backlog to come in there from all the pre-orders. And I'm not necessarily an early adopter with regard to the phones. I'm not like I need to have it in the moment. I still have an iPhone 5. And the fact that this is going to reduce the size of my apps and the fact that I have a 16-gigabyte iPhone 5 means that I get some extra space.
16 gigabit, unfortunately, for iOS 7 to iOS 8, wasn't big enough.
Yeah, there's many people that couldn't update because they didn't have enough room to download
the 5 gigs
of space.
I had to delete Facebook and Twitter.
Good choice.
Those were your big ones? Yeah, because they cached so much information. Each of them literally were taking up two and a half gigabytes of space.
That's a really good trick. If you are running out of space on your mobile phone or iPad or tablet of any sort, and you having trouble with like upgrading or putting more images on, go ahead and delete something like Facebook or Twitter where all the data is still there. Like you can delete that entire app, the entire thing will get erased, and then it'll download again and you'll start running it again. Like you're not going to lose anything if you could delete those things.
Right.
Lots of times people will go and go, I'll delete these movies, or do I have a copy of that? And it'll be deleting personal data. But when you're dealing with a cloud service like that, you can't really delete it. In fact, even if you ask them to delete it, they won't.
Yeah. In fairness, they've gotten better. Mm-hmm. I've looked at the usage. They haven't ballooned quite as much as they used to. But it was I remembered looking down and going, like, what am I usage? And going,
This isn't fair.
2 gigabytes? What?
Just to share photos with my family?
And also keep in mind that most of that, of course, is cache, right? The actual application is probably relatively small. So you download the application, and as you start using it, it might get larger and larger. That's good that it's not growing as it used to. Is that because of your use pattern, or do you think they're doing better about caching?
I think they're just getting better about it.
Yeah. All right.
So the thing about this is the 16 gigabytes is so small, but there are so many people.
Listen to what you're saying, man.
I know. That's why I hesitate, because the geek in me is like, what are you talking about? All these phones are the bottom of the line of the iPhones is still 16 gigabytes, and there's a ton of Android phones out there that are 16 gigabytes.
Yeah, right.
But it's exciting that people who buy these products that are running into that space cap are actually going to get a lot more use out of the phone, a lot more longevity out of the phone by adopting these technologies.
I would feel amiss if we didn't say Apple shouldn't be selling 16 gig phones at this point. When they have such good cameras, video cameras and everything on those devices, they should at least make it 32 or 64 as the base.
Right.
It doesn't cost them that much more. They're doing it completely because they can. And on Android devices, yes, you're right, there's a lot of 16 gigs, but a lot of Android devices have memory slots. So you just stick an SD card in there.
Those are going away these days.
I know, which is so frustrating. Oh, man.
But, you know, I see my dad. I see my other people that use these, and they don't need more than 16 gigabytes. And this is going to extend the life of what they do need.
And, of course, you know, Apple would say, well, just use iCloud, and then you can erase your photos as you go.
That's the idea, $5 a month or going up from there.
By the way, I did hear about a feature recently. If you're using Google Photos, which I happen to use because I like a few of their features, if you trust Google with all your photos, when you run out of space on your phone, if you've got Google Photos installed and it's been backing up photos, Google will actually say, actually, you're running out of space. And you could delete a whole bunch of your photos because we already have these up online for you, you know, safe. Which is kind of a nice feature of them to do. I haven't noticed it because I've got a giant phone. Let's go on with some energy news. Mr. Elam?
Well, sort of about energy. Mostly it's about the Department of Energy.
Politics.
And government. Well, not so much politics. It's more to do with the fact that every organization of a given size is going to have hackers try to break into their networks.
Yeah. Assuming you're online.
Yes. In fact, I remember not that long ago having a cable modem, those early days, linking up to it and being able to see traffic for my neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
On there, and having it be widely available. And if you have – I don't know if this is true anymore. I haven't tried it lately. But it used to be the case that if you took a computer and you had, say, packet sniffing software running on it, and you plugged it directly into that DSL modem or into that cable modem, you would see almost immediately traffic trying to hit your box, trying to break in.
This is that whole thing when you installed like Windows XP without a service pack. If that's what you had,
well, that would
you'd be really careful.
Yeah, within 2 minutes.
You'd be compromised so quickly because all these people would be scanning your ports and because there's vulnerabilities. And so it was one of those things where, how do I get it upgraded without being online?
So. Right. So that's everyone. That's the baseline.
Yeah.
Like the internet is not a safe place.
No.
Going beyond
DARPA.
Then you start getting into organizations that have name recognition, your Amazons, your Googles. They're getting a whole bunch of people who are trying to specifically target them, not just do a scatter attack, like hoping we'll get someone, but trying to get
focus attacks, yeah.
But you're also going to get attempts to go into government agencies like the Department of Energy. Question is, how successful are they? Well, they reported that since from about 2010 to 2014, they had a little over 1,000 attacks trying to get in, like of concerted attacks.
Okay. Like, over 4 years?
Yes.
All right.
Not just like the random noise that you have, but someone really trying to break into the systems. That's the scary part. The bad news is that 159 of those hacks were successful.
No, that's not good.
Successful defined by?
Yeah, what does that mean?
As in they were able to
do something.
Get in, see the network. Yeah, and the Department of Energy is not being forthcoming with regard to
what they were able to do after
that. Yes. Like what systems they actually had access to. And so this is going to be like, are they getting access to the grid? Are they getting access to, power plants?
Or is it like financial information? Who knows?
Right. Or, are they going to be starting getting, are they going to be getting a spreadsheet of all of the salary information for everyone who works for the Department of Energy.
This story is from USA Today. And so was it that – how did we get this knowledge? How did we find this out? Was it one of those, you know, ask for documentation kind of thing where the Department of Energy had to actually give the report over?
I believe so.
Yeah.
But it's a review of the records of that agency.
Over 4 years, 1,000 times attacked and 159 times successfully. It is kind of scary to hear that you don't know what that success is, considering the Department of Energy, you know, runs our
one
power
of things,
system. In the
yeah,
country.
One of the statements about it from the Department of Energy was that and this is after a specific attack in 2013, that there are more than 100,000 Energy Department employees and contractors, and it's not always clear who's in charge or who bears responsibility for any given task.
That's great. Well, yeah, that was broken into. What happened?
Right.
Don't know.
41 servers and 14 workstations were, quote, configured with default or easily guessed passwords.
Yeah, that'll work. All right, let's talk about something that's not broken, shall we? Because that sounds pretty broken.
So let's see, security's broken. Science, that's not broken, is it?
I don't think so. What do you mean science, like the scientific method?
Scientific
or the
method,
way we
yeah.
actually do science in this country?
So there's this great article. There's a website called 538. I think they're part of, what is it, the Wall Street Journal now? No,
New York Times.
The New York Times, thank you. But it was originally started, the number 538 refers to the number of electoral college members you need to win a presidential election, and that's where they made their mark, that they were so good at analyzing statistics and analyzing data that they were able to predict better than anybody else the outcome of the election. But this article is about looking at science and talking about how you can look at the data and you can get different answers depending on whether you're looking for your answer or the right answer or just a result.
It's all about like statistical analysis.
It's statistical analysis, which, what is it? What's the phrase? There's lies.
There's damn, lies.
Lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Statistics. Yeah, yeah. So this article totally backs that up, but it's a great read about how this works, and they even
how
have
they, how they how what they do to get interesting data around this. Like,
well, there's a little try your own hat at analyzing data as a part of the article, where you get to choose what the variables are you're going to include in your study, specifically whether a Republican or a Democrat in office makes the economy better or not.
Okay, so that's like the question, right?
Right, that's the question. Right. Does a Republican or does a Democrat improve the economy more?
And so right off the bat, you have to go, well, what's the metric on an improved economy?
Well, what data are you going to put in there, and right. how are you going to look at that data, and what measure are you going to show significant?
See, I would say that that's such a large question that's not really a scientific question, right?
Oh, no, no. Well, it's data analysis. It uses
right,
the scientific
but...
method. The idea is that people... in some cases, are losing faith in science. They're losing faith in the idea that this method works. And the article cites all of these hiccups that have been going on, like scientific journals that are accepting papers. This one was, get me off your expletive mailing list. That was the name of the paper. And all it included was 10 pages of repeated words, 7 words over and over
and again. It got in the journal?
And it got in the journal. And people are seeing things like this and going, oh, this
That's
system of science
review.
Is not yeah. working. But it outlines how this is happening, why this is happening, but more importantly, that what science is you can't just look at one piece of data. You can't just look at one analysis of the data. You can't look at just one study and take that as an answer.
And the actual idea behind publishing your study in a peer review journal is so that other people can look at the data and how you did the experiment, potentially reproduce it, but also poke holes at the problems they might see in it.
Right.
With the idea that people are stupid and even really smart people make mistakes.
Well,
so you have to be in a situation where you have to kind of do the best you can to really clarify what you did. And then let other people see it and inspect it, because without that, you won't find the problems.
Yeah. Not every study, not every scientific endeavor is as valuable as another. One that's been looked at by more people and people attempting to poke holes in it and attempting to prove that it's wrong is a more valuable study, more valuable piece of science.
Mm-hmm.
And and face it, we're humans using this system of science, and humans are fallible.
Well, we're really good at being fallible.
We're really good at seeing patterns, which means we're really good at seeing patterns that aren't there. So if we think we see something in the data, we have to be able to prove it with a method that somebody else can look at the same data or another set of data and find the same proof. And if you can't do that, then that's not an answer.
I will say an excellent way to find out if a study is worthwhile or not, if you're just if you're a non-scientist, just a person out there in the world, is to find out if the person put out a press release about their findings before it was submitted to a journal. Uh-huh. If it's someone goes, yeah, here's the press release, here we're getting this out there, look what I found, it's
not science
almost
based.
Always well, going the, to be
right, because the press release is a marketing gimmick, right? It's not about science,
right?
If they're going to the public before they go to the journals,
right? It's a PR move, not a science move.
So Brian, you were describing this earlier to me, and you were saying that one of the things they did was take a data set and asked a whole bunch of people to look at that data set and get answers from it. What is that?
Yeah, so specifically the data set was it was looking at a soccer. In soccer, the referees.
Wait,
can...
You mean football?
No, I mean football to the rest of the world,
okay.
But soccer in our,
okay,
in our neck of the woods. But what they did is they took this data of soccer referees, and whether the question was, do soccer referees give red cards to somebody with dark skin more than somebody with light skin?
Okay, this is good because. This is like points and score of a game is really well documented.
Oh yeah,
right?
There's lots of
and there's data. Lots of soccer games. So they took this data, and this is basically like all the different plays of a whole bunch of teams, and then skin colors of people in the team, and then the refs that actually gave the foul or whatever they are, right?
Right.
And then you give that out, and you say, okay, everybody, give a report and see if there's bias, which I'm assuming there is because people.
Well, that's the thing. There was a number of approaches taken. There's approaches like linear regression techniques and complex multi-level regressions and Bayesian approaches.
Okay.
These are all different statistical ways of looking at the data. And what happened was...
How many people participated in looking at the data? Do you know?
Well, there were 61 analysts,
okay,
but they were teamed up. So 20 of the teams looked at the data, and they concluded... that the referees did give more red cards to somebody who had dark skin over
white
skin.
Is a red card bad in soccer?
Well, yeah. It's
a foul?
You have to sit out. It's a foul. You,
okay.
your
you're
team
kicked
is...
out of the game, and you may be kicked out from a following game as well.
Yeah.
Wow, it's pretty serious.
It's a real admin.
This is like when you accidentally hit, or you intentionally do something
yes,
wrong.
Yes, it's considered an intentional foul.
Okay.
Yeah, an intentional and egregious foul.
Right. So you could say that the player had some malice even. They were not being sportsmanlike. But the interesting thing is, while 20 teams concluded that was true, there was 9 teams that said, no, they didn't find any significant relationship. And these were good researchers. These weren't just people that were just pulled out of schools or something.
Okay. And is that because the way they decided to look at this data varied? Because it wasn't different numbers.
No, it wasn't different numbers, but it was different techniques, and it was judging how to use that data. There's something in science called the p-value.
That's how valid the numbers are, right?
It's a way of where's my Wikipedia answer to this? But it's a way of judging whether the number is a significant difference.
Let me read it. In statistics, the p-value is a function of the observed sample results that is used for testing a statistical hypothesis. Before the test is performed, a threshold value is chosen, called the significance level of the test, traditionally 5% or 1%, and denoted as A. The p-value, you know what? This is going to get bad.
Yeah, exactly. The important thing here is you pick a number that you believe that is the threshold, the minimum number that you have to reach before this is significant. And that number is not always clear.
Significant as in something, a number that's actually useful. That's
yeah,
not just
that,
noise.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. That anything below that number is not a way to judge whether this is an important result. It could be random factors or human bias getting in the way. So the p-value has been played with, and there are people that are feeling that this p-value for various kinds of studies needs to be raised, that the bar is too low on many studies. And they're just trying to put forth the idea that science needs to be more rigorous.
Okay, so more rigorous means basically doing this better. But the problem I have with this is that I'm assuming that statistical analysis on like the soccer thing was not about the p-value specifically. Or was it? Was it just about whether they paid attention to noise or not?
Well,
or was it more about the process of what numbers they paid attention to?
It was both. It was like, where do you judge that significance and what numbers do you put into your analysis to judge as important? And all of those things have human biases involved. And that's why we have to have multiple studies, multiple teams look at this and argue about what really is significant.
Interesting. Cool. Well, thank you. You know, to listen to Geek Speak, that's Brian Young. I'm Lyle Troxell, and also here is Miles. Right, Miles?
Yes, I am.
And we'll be here in just a minute, so stay with us, won't you? It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Miles Elam and Brian Young. We're talking about science, I guess. So let's talk about space science. Since Ben's not here, Miles, would you mind?
Yes. It's hard to find good 4K media out there.
Can I do the obligatory? You can find some on Netflix because I work for Netflix. But you're right. There's actually not a lot of 4K media. Mm-hmm. And even the Netflix Row that I get for like in the US is like
4K
50
meaning,
titles.
Yeah, 4K meaning like right now we talk about 720p and 1080p.
Oh yeah, we talk about that all the time. Talk about quality of image, right? Yeah, 720 and 1080.
Yeah, HD TV.
Right.
Versus the standard definition TV. You know, that jump up from a DVD disc to Blu-ray to the streaming
and
media.
4K is the newest of that. And some of the new TVs that came out in December last have 4K support.
Right.
So, 4K, so newer is better, right?
Yeah. It's
more pixels.
Four times as many pixels as HD TV.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. Right. But it also means you need a really big TV to take advantage of it.
Or you need and to so sit really close, which my mom was very clear on when I was growing up.
But you do end up with this, how do you find the material? Because you can't just take an existing DVD and suddenly have it be really high definition. Just the information isn't there. Well, we've got a new source for you. NASA is launching a 4K TV channel.
Yes, baby. Very slow footage. That's beautiful.
But they have some very pretty pictures. And if you're going to be looking at something pretty, NASA's going to give it to you.
And you know, speaking of high resolution, they have insane resolution because they'll do scans and scans. Like that, that
they,
moon
they have
scanning
to scale down to get to 4K.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So cool.
Such as the Kepler Space Telescope, which... And if you've been following along, you'll know that...
It's the one that detects planets, right?
This is... Yes. And it's also broken.
Oh, no.
Like,
I missed this one.
It's got two of the wheels don't work. Like, so focusing and getting it right in the right position has been difficult. And still, over the course of 4 years, being, you know, broken in a sense, it's still been able to discover 22 planets.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
22 planets orbiting a star... someplace else.
And like, I have perfect 2020 vision. I've never discovered a planet except for the one I'm on.
So hopefully some of these things will show up on NASA's 4K
what's
TV.
What's it called? NASA TV?
Well, yeah. NASA has NASA TV. Are they just switching NASA TV over to 4K? Because that's been around for ages.
Well, I would assume that would be the same thing as what the cable companies do now, where they have one channel standard definition and another channel that's HD.
Well, I mean,
there would be some other channels.
This is
going to
be streaming only, right? I mean, 4K is you can't deliver it through normal cable means.
I don't see why not. Four times the pixels, that means you take up the channel bandwidth of four channels.
Yeah, but I don't know of any provider that's actually offering that yet.
That's kind of the point. I don't think there's cable companies that are actually spitting out 4K. I could be wrong, though.
This is supposed to be...
That's one of the dilemmas, actually, is trying to find someone who would serve it.
And... You're sure that Kepler is actually kind of broken? How long has it been broken? The entire time?
Pretty much.
Whoa.
When it was launched, they had failures of one wheel that was used to orient... And then they lost a second one, and I think they had issues with a third one. But I'd have to go back and double-check that.
Let's talk more about science, shall we? We'll continue. So a story about NASA having awesome television, and Kepler actually is broken, still successfully finding planets. Fantastic. Brian?
There is a survey that came out from the Pew Center.
That's the best survey company that I know. Pew, because it sounds like laser guns. Pew!
Well, they wanted to find out whether Americans know science, and we've heard these kind of studies before.
I know the answer to that.
We've heard these studies before, and it's just kind of fun to go through this after having talked about what the problems with science are these days. But did you have some of those questions with you, Miles?
Oh, yeah. They have things like, what color is the brain?
Yeah.
And it's a multiple choice, so it's not like you have to just come up with that. But
well, give me the multiple choices. I know the answer.
Gray.
Gray, because, you know.
Pink.
Yeah.
Or multiple colors.
Gray. Well, right?
It's multiple colors.
Darn.
Oh, this is the one I actually got wrong.
You know, well, the only reason I'm doing that is because of Oingo Boingo. I mean, come on. Gray matter, gray matter.
Yeah. It also asks things
so
like.
So multiple colors? How many colors?
Well, there's gray matter, there's white matter, there's also there's the various blood vessels that are there. So those are going to show up as either red or blue, depending upon, you know,
vessels or arteries and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or how far. How
well, what other kind of survey questions? Oh, wait, what was the percentage of people that knew?
Well, so the average American, there are 21. No, there's 12 questions, which I ask you, out of 12 questions, is that significantly or statistically significant on what our American understanding of science is?
No.
This is the problem with this study.
Okay, what is another one?
Well,
okay.
it hits some fairly, they had some broad strokes. I mean, honestly, these were not hard questions.
I'm definitely answering because it's fun. But
you could get some hiccups by you didn't really understand the question.
Well,
you
come on, there's only 7
one.
Of them. Let's ask another one.
No, well, there's 12 of them.
Okay, 12.
But another one is waves. So what kind of waves are used to make and receive cell phone calls? Radio waves, light waves, sound waves, or gravity waves?
Yeah, yeah, I had a problem with that one because light waves and radio waves
are the same kind of waves.
But obviously they're looking for radio. But
Yes. So,
but light is perfectly valid as an answer.
It's the same spectrum. So the funny thing is, so we're talking about these, and they seem like they're pretty easy questions. 65%.
You know what? I'm sorry. Let me take that back. Light is not the same. Light specifically is electromagnetic that we can see. So infrared has to be called infrared light because it's modified light. Light is of the observer's perspective. So radio is not light unless it happens to be vibrating at the place where optical things can sense it. That's what might be my argument. What do you guys think?
That's a good definition. But which optics? That's... Because different creatures can see different spectrums.
Well, so light for one, I think light for one creature would be not light for another creature potentially. But definitely X-rays are not. We don't say X-rays are light. We say it's like light. But light is a subset.
Why do radio waves travel at the speed of light?
Because they are the same form.
Because they are photons.
I mean,
at a different frequency.
Okay, totally. Granted, I get what you're saying. I'm just saying to be as clear as you possibly could. You would not say that my radio emits light when it transmits. My cell phone does not use light to transmit.
But my
it uses the electromagnetic spectrum. Light is one of those things.
My flashlight does give off
radio
waves.
Absolutely.
Right.
So that's all. We don't have to get pedantic on this one if you don't want to. Let's go on. What's another one of these 12 questions?
Oh, the Earth's core. The outer layer is called the Earth's crust. The middle layer... No, wait a second.
Which is the hottest? The crust, the mantle, or the core?
So the outer layer, the middle layer, or the inner layer? And...
I would guess inner, but I don't know.
Yeah, and you would be right.
It's the core, yeah.
So they're not trick questions, really.
No, well, there is one that's been called into question because
I mean, besides the light and radio.
Well, meaning, why would this be on a test about science? So I'm just coming down to that question right here.
Oh, what is it?
So, which of these terms is defined as a study of how the positions of the stars and planets can influence human behavior?
Oh, that's not a science question at all.
The answers are astrology, alchemy, astronomy, or meteorology.
Okay, so that word is astrology.
Did I say that wrong?
No. I'm just saying that's the word that the stars influence the human.
And I believe they added that one because there are so many people they have asked that were not sure which one was which and were entered...
I only know the difference of
astrology and astronomy.
Yeah,
you know.
And I only know the difference of those things really well because I'm a geek. Like, come on.
Well, that
the
you know
word
that one
sounds
of them
similar.
Is bunk.
Yeah, but that's because I get frustrated with that knowledge. Like, I'm frustrated that people, you know, have those belief structures, right? So astrology to me is not the same thing at all. But to most people, very smart people spend a lot of time telling you about astrology, and really smart people spend a lot of time telling you about astronomy. To them, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, but
I mean, it's not
the point
it's
of
not
these
other people's expertise.
The point of these kind of surveys and the point of this is that we're a democracy, and as a democracy, we vote in people that make laws. And if our population doesn't have some basic science knowledge, how are we going to protect ourselves
because,
in this
because
age
we use representative
of...
democracy, and that fixes everything because those people are smart.
Yes,
yeah,
those representatives will listen
House,
to the scientists.
Yeah, House Committee on Science and Technology. Not doing too well.
All right, let's move on. Shall we talk about discovery by chance? Any discoveries lately?
Well, yeah. So we were talking about news science papers and science studies that go to the news. Well, there's one that's been in the news this past week that was really big. We now have a new human, not an ancestor, but a new human cousin on the family tree of humans. And it's got the name, let's see if I can get this just right.
Oh, it's one of those great ones that's fun to say.
Homo Neldi. Nope, I didn't get it.
Naladi?
Naladi. Homo Naladi. And it's a really interesting story, though I'm going to say right up front that we don't have a lot of clear facts on the conclusions about this this cousin of ours. But this researcher, Lee Berger, in South Africa, was brought a bone fragment that he examined and decided that this is a really interesting find. And
fossilized bone fragment, I'm assuming? What kind of time period?
Yeah, a fossilized jawbone. Mm-hmm. And they went to inspect the cave where this was found. Now, this was really difficult. He could not fit into the part of the cave where this bone fragment was pulled
out. Oh, I heard about that story. I didn't know where they were actually studying. So they got people that could get in a 7-inch diameter hole, right?
Yes, this super tiny hole, which when I was a kid, I went through a cave like this. It's incredibly scary to me now.
Yeah.
Back then, it was really fun.
At UCSC, there's the hell hole is one of the caves. It's actually closed off right now. But there's a part of that called the birth canal, and you had to... You had to crawl through it with your arms in front of you. If you put your arms to your side, you get stuck.
Right.
Did we ever do that?
Oh, yeah.
And
it freaked me out then, too.
And you had to go up at an angle, and then there was a turn point, and you had to rotate your hips a certain way to get around it. And then at the end of it, you drop off into void.
Now, and you had to be physically fit.
You had to be physically fit.
And on your feet so you don't
fall. You couldn't do rope, because if you do rope, you get snarled. It's one of those things that now, I shudder to think that I did that so many times. Anyway, yes, I know that feeling of crawling through. So who was able to do that? They were actually able to get people in this cave, I'm assuming, to find out?
Yeah. So the researcher, he put out a advertisement to find, he called them astronauts, or cave astronauts, I believe. And this is called the Rising Star Cave outside of Johannesburg. And what it was there was two parts of this cave that were so small, he needed somebody incredibly fit and incredibly skilled at going through small spaces. I believe most of them, if not all of them, were women, very fit women. So behind these multiple chambers, there was a chamber 30 meters underground, and they found...
That's deep.
Yes. They found infants, children, adults, elderly individuals, all of the same species of a cousin of ours. So they haven't... I can't say that word. Thank you.
So that's what I'm assuming, that this cousin of ours was actually smaller than us.
It was smaller than us, about 5 feet tall. They have not dated how old these bones fossils are yet, but they do have some information about it. So the brain size of this was no more than an orange.
Whoa.
So much different head shape and...
Why are we calling them homos? Why are we calling them human, of the human genome? They're enough human?
Well, there are parts of them that are very ancient, and there's parts of them that look much more modern. Like their feet are incredibly modern compared to many other specimens of...
Of chimpanzees and other kind of primates.
Yes.
Okay.
So they definitely walked up on two legs.
Okay, cool.
And the other thing that's really peculiar, which this is where the researchers are putting forth an idea, but they... This one will be argued for a long time. They believe this was a burial chamber. And to date, the only species that on the Homo tree or any other species that buries their dead is humans.
Homo sapiens. Huh?
So they see this as a behavior that of a highly intelligent creature that was burying their dead. This one will be argued for a very long time.
I would assume. Cool, thanks. I think we might have time for one more story from Miles in just a second, but I want to let you know that you're listening to GeekSpeak. If you have questions and comments about the show, please feel free to contact us up at geekspeak.org, and you can send us information on Twitter, on Facebook and stuff. We're KOSP Geeks. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know the geek said hello. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at KOSP.org. To find out more information, visit geekspeak.org. Our song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxa with Brian Young, Miles Elam. We also have Greg Mercury and Chandler supporting us. This is a September 19th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak. Miles, your story.
There's a library in New Hampshire that was looking to allow surfing the web anonymously using Tor. They were going to be an exit node, which cool. is one of the hardest things to find. They have decided they're not going to after the Department of Homeland Security sent them an email and after meeting with law enforcement officials about how legal liability may be at issue for them if they do so. So it's now up in the air.
I hope they win. Live free or die. New Hampshire, baby.
Well, this is something that comes into question of what can you get at the library and what was the historical use of it. But in the internet age, what about someone who isn't even attached to the library if they were able to do that? So.
Well, interesting. Anonymity from the library. Well, thank you very much, Miles and Brian. Thank you very much. We'll be here next week. Please stay tuned on KOSP. Thanks for listening to GeekSpeak.